China Carbon Forum recently met up with Mr. Tim Yeo, former chair of the UK's Parliament Energy and Climate Change Committee. In a wide-ranging interview centered on China, we discussed many things, such as carbon markets, the Paris COP, shale gas, and IP protection. I start the interview by asking Tim about his support for a global carbon market.
I'm a great enthusiast for the long-term goal of a global carbon market. I think that's it is a long way off, obviously, but if you think about it, if you had an effectively implemented global cap and trade system, perhaps with using as the cap the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report of the maximum state, you can't need any other policies at all. That does it. Hmm. Yeah, if it's effectively enforced, and it's a market instrument which should ensure efficient allocation of capital.
If you spoken about this in China before, the Chinese capital?
Not quite so. I'm going to say it tomorrow morning. Not quite so directly as that. No. Yeah. But I think people I've talked to privately know that's my view. And people at home, like Sir David King, who now at the Foreign Office was the Chief Scientific Advisor, he is a supporter of that concept. I'm sure there are people in the emissions trading business, I mean IETA and others, who would say that's a good long-term goal as well. But I think that, given that I think we've been through the sort of danger period with emissions trading. About 5 years ago, it looked as though the concept might just completely discredit it. It still isn't working terribly well, but the EU ETS has survived, and I think now we'll pull out of this bad phase. May take another 5 years to do so. You've got China taking it up really seriously with the pilots. We believe are going to be, there's going to be an announcement in the 13th five-year plan about the national system. Mm-hmm. Once you've got, that's a quarter of the world's population, over a third of the world's GDP, saying emissions trading is part of the answer to climate change, it comes quite hard for the rest of the world to ignore it. And you've got adding California, the most advanced state in the US.
And several other parts of North America.
Exactly. So the signs are much more hopeful than they were five years ago. I've been an enthusiast for emissions trading for over 20 years, since I first understood the concept in about 1993. I thought, this has got to be part of the answer. A lot of people are still dead against it. And we may well, very likely, need, in the meantime, carbon taxes as well, and lots of other measures. But ultimately, we could rely on this.
Tomorrow's forum, the headline is linkages.
Yeah.
As an Australian, we're going down that track.
I remember.
Reversed tack. Do you see some other linkages on the horizon?
I think they're not immediately on the horizon. I mean, the EU has already said it would not link with a sub-national system. It would link with a... I suspect that could be changed. In fact, you look at places like California, like Guangdong province, they are bigger than most EU member states. Guangdong population is bigger than any EU member state. California is a third or fourth largest. So I think that could change. But the official policies don't link with a sub-national scheme. Secondly, of course, in China, we don't yet have systems which are subject to an absolute cap. So you couldn't have a complete trading platform. Obviously, it wouldn't work. But as I say, it's, like we said tonight, it's about keeping that long-term aim in mind so that as you design new features in the system, you do it in a way which you think is going to make them compatible in the long-term future. Now, the Australian thing, I think, was abandoned more because of a change of heart in the politics of Australia rather than defects in the proposal itself. And that was my impression from the outside. Anyway.
I guess one feature of working in China is that the policy direction is more one way than the other, we don't face quite the same.
I mean, that's an interesting contrast between China and the EU. And the EU is a convoy which moves the speed of the slowest to the 28 ships, which on this issue is pretty slow. But in China, that's not quite the same. It can move very quickly if they choose, which is an advantage in some respects. It has some downsides, but I think it is an advantage. I think, given the torturous progress that that ETSs have made so far, you can't expect this to happen very quickly. But I keep going to the point, let's keep it in mind, because even if we inch this way and that way and that way, we make forward progress, however slowly, it's in the right direction, and it will help. What I'm keen is to try and get this kind of in people's mind a bit for Paris, so that at least from the COP, nothing happens which makes this more difficult. I mean, I heard Robert Stavins from Harvard making this point quite well in New York last year, saying, you know, we don't expect the main headline out of Paris to be, oh, the world's going to go for a global cap and trade, but it would at least be nice if nothing came out of it which actually made that goal harder to achieve.
Yeah.
Such as?
Well, I think that, I'm slightly nervous about the Pope's intervention, actually. I think that you can get some negative stuff said about carbon trading as an instrument. What does it do for poorer countries? Well, actually, it could do a lot for poorer countries if you had an allocation system that was fair. They could make money out of it straight up. You know, the other advantage of it, almost any form of carbon tax has a regressive impact on poorer people and poorer countries. Almost anyone does. A properly designed cap and trade system can have a progressive, it can be a transfer of wealth to poorer countries.
Right. Do you have any general thoughts about Paris COP? What would you like to see? What do you think is realistic? Your sense from UK government, the objectives there perhaps, and the hopes?
I think, firstly, the background is much better than before Copenhagen in 2009, I think much more realistic. I think the whole approach, which has a bottom-up as well as a top-down dimension to it, is absolutely right. And we've seen countries saying things that they wouldn't have said if it was going to be forced on them like that. So that's philosophically, it's right this time. And I think expectations generally are more realistic. I think also the world has moved on. The business community is much more committed. You know, that statement by the oil companies in Europe last month, that wouldn't have happened in 2009. What was said here by the two presidents last year, again, that wouldn't happen. That wouldn't have happened 2 or 3 years ago, actually. Mm-hmm. So all that's good context. Now, what will come out of it? Your guess is probably much better than mine. The UK government's position, the UK government has changed. if I'd been having this conversation with you 9 weeks ago, I'd have said we're all expecting another coalition. That was what the opinion polls pointed towards. Even the Prime Minister was surprised. You probably didn't see the interview, but the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, was on the big Sunday politics programme, Andrew Marr show, on Sunday morning, and he said, you know, we kind of believe the opinion polls. After you get 6 weeks of opinion polls saying exactly the same thing, even though your instincts say surely we're going to win, but the polls don't say that, so you think, okay, it's going to be another coalition. Suddenly, it's a Conservative government. Now, that isn't necessarily going to change the approach to the COP, but it might, and it's not. They haven't really said very much on the record since the election about what they're going to do. There was quite a good statement before the election by the three UK party leaders, all signed up to a sort of manifesto which one of the NGOs, it was the Green Alliance, put together, and saying that they were attaching top priority to tackling climate change and so on. So hopefully it'll be a very constructive engagement, but of course, I mean, you know, the UK acts through the EU in these negotiations anyway. So, but I think that given that the UK was one of the countries, one of the EU member states, which argued very strongly for the 40% emissions reduction target for 2030, we were really rooting for that one. Mm. I think that's a good sign. In fact, we were arguing for a more challenging rather than a less challenging target. So I think we'll be in there trying to do the same thing, broadly speaking. But I don't hold my breath for any kind of global breakthrough out of Paris. I think when you've got nearly 200 countries involved, it's very hard. I've been to three COPs. I went to Copenhagen and the two following ones. I found them a bit, not just hard work, but a bit depressing, really. I mean, everyone's out there with a begging bowl or something rather than that. That distracts from the main event, really.
So last Tuesday, China announced its INDC. Mm. Well, it's interesting from sort of looking at analysis from it. There was obviously a 2020 target for a 40% carbon intensity, 40 to 45% carbon intensity target. And China has now stated 2030 it will look to achieve a 60 to 65% intensity target. And a lot of analysts are saying that that's not enough, given that it's currently projected to quite easily achieve the 2020 target.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were sort of interested to see perhaps if you had any reflections on that.
Well, I think that there's a cultural point that I think if China announces a target, they do so when they're absolutely certain they're going to achieve it.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't be too depressed about the fact the targets aren't as challenging as we would like them to be, because I think the expectation is that they will comfortably exceed them, both in times and amount. That would be my instinctive reaction. That's not a reason not to say, come on, let's do something more challenging. You can certainly argue for that, but I would not be uncomfortable about it. And I think, again, looking what they say in 2009, they weren't talking about those kind of public targets at all. So that is, in a sense, they've also responded to, in a way that other countries have, going further than they would have done, even though it's not far enough.
Do you see the tide sort of changing in terms of China's role on the international stage with regards to climate change? That actually China can become more of an influencer on the global stage, generally speaking?
I do. I think that's already happening. I think for several reasons. I think the level of engagement with the issue here has been transformed compared with 10 years ago. And I've been here quite a lot in the last 10 years. It just doesn't bear any relation at all to what it was like 10 years ago. I think secondly, they're driven also by the air quality issues here now as well. Very helpful as it happens. I mean, ghastly if you live here, but very helpful in terms of getting people to do the right thing. Mm. Thirdly, in a way paradoxically, but there's a paradox in what we were just saying just now about the fact in China they won't announce a target unless they're sure of achieving it. In a Western democracy, you announce targets all the time, and you don't even believe them when you say them. It's not quite funny, but that's the lot that's up for re-election. The lot here are not up for re-election, and yet they're much more disciplined and rigorous about it. It just shows the cultural differences. But I think it relates to this point as well. I think that the Chinese government does not have the comfort, or even one might say from a Democrat's point of view, the legitimacy of being elected. Therefore, they're, oddly enough, much more responsive to public opinion than someone who's been elected. You know, if you're the US president, you just go up by your second term, you can do what you like for 4 years. The UK government could do what it likes for 5 years. Yeah, they're really nervous about that. So that's why they're really worried about the air quality issue. But I think gradually there's beginning to be an understanding for people outside China about what they're doing here. Now, obviously the problem is still hideous. I mean, absolutely hideous. And they've got to move much faster with the dependence on coal. But I think they kind of realise that. And until probably 4 or 5 years ago, people kind of bought the George W. Bush line, oh, well, China's not doing anything, so why should we? You know, that was kind of believed by lots of Americans. It's still believed by some, I think, but a much reduced number. So I think there's a recognition that they're doing things here. Therefore, people will pay attention to what they say. I also sense, but this is a much more sort of outsider's observation that I don't really know, I sort of sense that China itself wants to play a bigger role here, which they didn't want to 6 years ago. And it's part of a kind of change in the whole sort of, you know, China's position, not just on climate change, lots of other issues as well, some of which may not be quite so comforting, but there's a bit of flexing of muscles taking place.
They've very clearly identified some key industries which they want to plough resources into, which they see as engines for growth in this coming century. So that's part of it.
Yeah. I mean, just en passant, I mean, another issue I'm very interested in is nuclear power, where we've got a very active debate in the EU at the moment, about half the countries in favour, about half against. And one of the other jobs I'm doing is chairing a consortium of nuclear companies looking at how to promote revival of nuclear power across the EU. And the Chinese are very keen to get into the UK market, and they've got this deal, which is not completely signed off, with EDF, you know, being a minority investor in the first nuclear power station to be built in the UK, Hinkley Point, which has run into some severe technical problems with the manufacturing of one of the vessels. Deal is, if they put the money into that, they will get a majority stake in one of the other sites for a nuclear power station in the UK, which they'll use their own technology in. And I think they expect to be able to roll that out at some volume, and not just in the UK, but across the EU probably. So, I mean, that's the sort of industry where I think they see they can get a global market position, and also be seen to be doing the right thing on climate change, you know, because nuclear is a low carbon technology.
You're very much a supporter of shale gas now.
Yes. But for two reasons. One is, I think that gas is a transitional fuel source for the UK, I think probably for the world. But there's no doubt in the next 15 years the UK is going to consume a lot of gas, and I think it would be better to consume our own than to import it from outside, I think for security reasons. And secondly, if we don't exploit our own shale, it's not really how much there is because we haven't drilled enough holes yet, but if we don't, one of the sources we will import is LNG from the Middle East, and the science shows that because of the process of liquefying and unliquefying, the sort of life cycle carbon emissions of gas during electricity that originates as LNG is actually higher than if you're producing it yourself. So there's a, it's a small, but it is a significant reduction in emissions. Now, all that is postulated on the assumption that using our own shale gas will not weaken our determination to find lower carbon sources. Now, I accept that's a debatable point, because there is a risk if we finally had lots of it, we say, oh, let's not bother with some of the other things. I wouldn't support that at all. I'm simply saying as a practical matter, I don't see how we get to 2030 without the UK using a great deal of gas. It's a transitional fuel. I mean, I also support the view that electricity generation has to be almost completely decarbonised by the 2030s. So it isn't a long-term solution. That's why I'm in favour of nuclear. That's why I'm excited about solar. That's why I'm disappointed that the UK government has stopped the support for onshore wind sooner than expected. Because onshore wind also has the potential to be close to grid parity in the next 10 years. And it's a pity if we're going to drop out of that race.
A related point, I mean, given the urgency of the technological revolution that needs to happen, China potentially has a huge role to play here, right? Just because they have they've done impressive things with solar and wind already in terms of bringing down costs. Yeah, I don't know whether how close you watch this in China, but do you see enough ambition in that sense in terms of pioneering the new technologies that are going to provide, serious power?
I think one of the difficulties still here is concern about IP law. I mean, at home, I chair a company which is developing a hydrogen fuel cell, and we are going to deploy it in Korea, we're going to deploy it in Thailand, we're going to deploy it in Dubai, we're going to deploy it in America. We don't want to bring it here, even though doing so might enable us to get costs down faster, because the shareholders, I'm only a very small shareholder myself, but I am the chairman, they say, we don't want to run that risk. We've got a technology. If we take it to China, we may find we lose our lead. We've got a lead probably 2 to 3 years at the moment. It might be 2 to 3 months we bring it here. You know, I suspect other people may think the same way. I think the IP protection is much better than it used to be. I think there has been good progress there, but I suspect that some people who have got bright ideas are nervous about bringing them here to have them develop.
Do you see much potential in China with regards to shale gas, and also globally with regards to carbon capture and storage?
I don't know about shale gas. Yeah, I'm sure if they can find it, they will use it, because they don't like being import dependent anymore than anybody else. I think they're pretty sensitive about that. But I don't know. I don't know enough about what the terrain is like to know whether there's much potential here. On CCS. I'd love to think it's just around the corner, but I don't have the sense that it is. It is a technology which is transformational, and we do still need it. I mean, we need it for gas as much as for coal. Talking to people, it's just not economic. There's a marginal play, I think, where you get enhanced oil recovery. We get some possibility in the North Sea. They have some possibility, I think, off the coast here as well. Actually, off Guangdong province, in fact, there's some work. There's work going on down there. But I'm not holding my breath for a breakthrough there.
Yeah.
I'd love to think it's going to happen, but don't think. We can't make policy on the assumption that it will.